more, as we like to put it sometimes, what it means to be a Christian businessman, that discussions of this sort are misleading and dangerous. On two counts, from a social standpoint and from an individual standpoint. From the standpoint of society, it is very dangerous to have groups of businessmen sitting around and talking about their social responsibilities, because businessmen really have no social responsibilities in any sense different from that in which we all have social responsibilities. And unfortunately, businessmen too often don't realize this. The main reason they don't realize that they have no peculiar social responsibilities is because the rest of society keeps telling them they do. You know, they just believe the larger society, which is always talking about the necessity for the businessman to exercise his social responsibilities. How terribly dependent we are today upon social responsibility in the large corporation, or social responsibility on the part of those thousands of men who make up the business community. Well, when clergymen and politicians and university officials and all the good people in society say something long enough, people start to believe it. And I say, first of all, this is disastrous from a social standpoint, because this kind of talk persuades us ultimately to surrender the care of the public interest to private whim and caprice. That is dangerous, undemocratic, despotic, foolish. From an individual standpoint, all this talk, and I suspect yesterday's conversation, represents and encourages a tragic misunderstanding of ethics, and consequently misdirects the attention of businessmen who are genuinely interested in being ethical men. It misdirects their attention from what they ought to be looking at into an area where they can only encounter frustration and futility and failure. All right, let me deal with these two themes briefly. The first one, the social standpoint. All right, let me put it very briefly. As a businessman, the businessman's social responsibility is to make as much profit as he can, period. That's his job as a businessman. Just like your job as an engineer is defined in engineering terms. I mean, you don't say, what is your duty as an engineer, and then call in the clergyman. I mean, sure, the engineer is a human being, and the engineer is going to be more than a designer of bridges. But when you talk about someone's obligations and responsibilities as a physician, as an engineer, as an embalmer, whatnot, you don't feel that you've got to somehow go over and consult a moral authority. Some peculiar reason we don't realize this with businessmen. But the businessman's job is to make as much profit as he can. Now that sounds like heresy. I've been told by so many people that our country will fall apart if businessmen just maximize their profits. Baloney. When businessmen maximize their profits, they are acting in response to the dictates of the market. Because if you don't act in response to the dictates of the market, you won't maximize your profits. Why is it good to act in response to the dictates of the market? Simply because the market is a marvelously efficient social device for communicating the decisions of society about what it wants done with its resources to those who must implement society's decisions. The businessman who says, I could make a profit by shifting from this to that, or I could make more profit by shifting from this to that, but I won't do it because I've got a social responsibility not to. What that businessman is really saying is, society, through this communication and information system called the market, is telling me to shift from this to that. But I, out of a sense of social responsibility, choose to do not what society wants, but something else. Well, now, if you choose not to obey society, in what sense are you exercising a social responsibility? It must be that you think you know better than society. Maybe you do. More likely, you don't. Let me give just one example. If the case of the Detroit automobile manufacturers. A couple of years ago, you know, Congress got all excited about automobile safety and finally passed some legislation. And a lot of people said that how tragic it is that Congress had to act here. Why didn't the automobile manufacturers act themselves? Well, because it wasn't their job to act. It was the job of the automobile manufacturers to make those cars which would sell in such a fashion that the automobile manufacturers would make a maximum profit. And you say, oh, but they've got to be concerned about the welfare of the public. They were concerned about the welfare of the public. They were giving the public what the public wanted. And after all, what do you think contributes to your welfare, not what you want? You say, but they should have insisted on designing safety features. They've had safety features in those cars. The cars had brakes, decent tires. The question was more safety at the expense of other things. That was the real question. How much safety? How many safety devices do people want in? You could produce an automobile for about $10,000. If you mass produced it, it would be an ugly monster and terribly safe. I've seen one in the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry, designed by the National Association of Life Underwriters, where they say four people could survive a head-on crash at 60 miles per hour. But if any manufacturer came out with that car and tried to market it, you know what would happen? Nobody would buy it. Not only because it would cost so much, because they don't want it. The thing is, when we go out and buy a car, when I go out and buy a car, when you go out and buy a car, when 98% of the American people go out and buy a car, they're looking for pizzazz. They're not looking for safety. So you produce a safe car. Fine. You're a great public benefactor. The heck you are. What you will do is build safe cars that will sit in the dealer's showrooms. How does that contribute to automobile safety? If the problem is, and this is, I guess, really the problem, that all of us together are overly optimistic. Well, all of us tend to discount the importance of safety. Now, when you buy a car, you don't figure on making it your tune. You figure it's something you see yourself taking off, laying rubber and all that sort of stuff. People don't like to be reminded that they can kill themselves in these things. And so people aren't going to buy a car that does remind them of that. Well, now, if this creates a social problem, if, in other words, what the market, which brings together the wishes and preferences of all of the individuals in the society, taking account of what's available to satisfy those wishes. If the market gives a result that we as a collective people say is inadequate, then it is the job of the political process to intervene and correct the situation. It is not the task or the responsibility of some individual businessman who sets himself up as a benevolent tyrant over the rest of society. I am not saying that the market is all supreme. I do not believe in laissez-faire. I'm saying that the market is a marvelously efficient device for communicating essential information, and that there's no substitute for it if we want anything like the standard of living that we have. But I believe firmly in the veto of democratic politics over democratic economics. But I want that veto to be a veto of democratic politics. I do not think that because some man is president of General Motors or General Electric or any other large corporation, he should be the cultural and social and political and safety arbiter for the rest of society. Let me just illustrate with another kind of example. Some people get very concerned about the quality of our television programs. And they say, the fault lies with some of these men in the large corporations. They won't sponsor good programs. Well, what do they sponsor? They sponsor what the advertising people tell themselves, their razor blades or whatnot. And that's what I want them to do. Because do you really want the leading executives of America to be the cultural arbiters of this country? Do you want them to decide what we peons shall watch on our TV? Now, if what emerges from this process, where corporations ask themselves what kind of program will draw listeners, with what kind of income will be manipulated into spending it, in what kind of fashion, if we as a society do not like it, then it is our task to employ the political process to control the whole thing. If we want to have public television channels, or if we want government controls over the television industry, then let's get together and talk about that. But let's not appeal to a group of men called businessmen or big businessmen and ask them to be benevolent despots. One, they have no competence in this area. They don't know anything more about this than we do. Number two, it is extremely dangerous to have any kind of benevolent despot ruling you. I happen to believe that all despotism is unjust, but even benevolent despots don't remain benevolent too long. And you know, it's a funny thing. There's the people who get worried. They'll get indignant when they hear that some big right-wing businessman withdrew all of his advertising from a certain newspaper because it published an editorial in favor of open occupancy. And they'll get mad and say, "Oh, that's terrible. That's using your power as a businessman to control the political process. That's awful. That's awful." And yet they will turn around and expect businessmen to use their political power to influence the political process, I mean their economic power, to influence the political process in the right direction, you see. We get mad when businessmen influence things in the wrong direction. We want them to influence them in the right direction. And I think, well, let's cut the Gordian knot by saying businessmen have no business as businessmen in influencing the political process at all. As human beings, as citizens, sure, they should be in politics, just like all the rest of us should, and engaged in political discussion. But, say, the resources of the corporation, which are really owned by a wide variety of people, a large publicly held corporation, these resources should be employed to build up the profit position of that corporation, and they should not be used to manipulate society in accord with anybody's dream. On the second point, about the danger of talking about social responsibility from an individual standpoint, is this. A lot of people, let me say, a lot of businessmen today, I think, have kind of a status anxiety. I maybe speculate on why this is, but I think there's a lot of evidence that this is true. They're not as sure as they once were that what they're doing is meaningful and valuable. And so, they at least want people to realize that they're being ethical, that they're trying hard, that they're not just out for the almighty dollar, but they're motivated by service considerations, and by golly, their heart is good. And so that's why so many businessmen attend seminars and conferences on social responsibility and read books on the subject and are so willing to affirm their social responsibility. That's why people, Christians, are so eager to say, "Well, I'm a Christian businessman, or a Christian farmer, or a Christian dentist," and then, by golly, there's a difference too. Some of my colleagues maybe do that, but I practice Christian dentistry. Good. When I go to a dentist, I want my cavities filled. I don't care about his religion. There's been times in my life where I got shabby merchandise because I sort of fell out of patronized the fellowship. but now the point I want to make is being ethical, being good, is a matter of being, not doing. Doing is something that emerges from being. If you focus on doing, on acts, on good works, you will never attain your goal. You will never become good. I can put this in very traditional orthodox terms. You are justified by grace through faith, not by works. Good fruit is something that emerges from a good tree. And if you want to be a good tree, the place to begin is with your roots and your leaf structure and the whole process of photosynthesis. You don't begin by concentrating on the fruit. You don't run around spraying the fruit, first of all, to get a good fruit tree. In this whole area of discussion, I find so many businessmen convinced now that if only they can come up with codes of ethics to guide their conduct, which they, of course, will obey, more or less, as it fits the situation. I suspect most of these codes of ethics are kind of unrealistic, and they are, that's true. But they think that somehow then they will be good, and then they will be able to hold up their heads with pride, and then when the minister talks in the pulpit about the necessity of being having Christian concern, they will be able to say, yeah, I do. I obey all 10 points in the Realtors Code. Now, the tragedy of this is that it, for a Christian, it is doing just what St. Paul, when he wrote to the Galatians, tells the Galatians they must not do, and that is be captured again, return to the old slavery of supposing that somehow by the things that they do and the rules and regulations that they obey, they can prove themselves to be part of the community of God. You can't do it. And the businessman can't do it either. Even the non-Christian businessman, I'm afraid, is justified by grace, if he's justified at all. You've got to become a good man in order to be a good man. And how do you become a good man? There's no formula for this. And it's certain that no ethical code, no 10 points of honest real estate practice are going to make you a good man. A good man in business is simply a man, well, most basically is a man who's human, who's fully human, who you can describe him in some sense. You can say he's a man who's excited by what he's doing, at least at times, who, he's a man who, if he's married, loves his wife, and if he has children, takes good care of them. I can't describe, what does it mean to be human? All of the things which it means to be human, these are the things that it takes to be an ethical businessman. An ethical businessman is a man in business who is fully human. This fundamental and vitally important fact is so often overlooked then because people get all, through this talk about social responsibility, get hung up in ethical codes. Thus, I would say it's sort of a working rule. If you are a businessman, and if you are concerned about the quality of ethics in the business community, and you want to have a conference to do something about it, don't have a conference on business ethics. Have a conference on art in the life of the businessman. Or the use of leisure time. Or some human consideration. Work at making yourself human and your colleagues human. And as for the concept of social responsibility, let it be forever buried. Well, I made my speech. I did it I'm proud, in 22 minutes. I hope we can have a discussion now for the next 25 minutes. Harold!
Well, about the first part of his speech, which I object to less than the second part of his speech.
go ahead.
I don't understand how you can say that you believe that big business should proceed in the direction of, you know, maximizing their profits and this and that, without recognizing at the same time that they're definitely manipulating their profits. It seems to me that you suggested that this is, you know, we should let business be business, and that business shouldn't try to incorporate into its business practices certain, you know, concerns about the ethical realities of the situation they're in. It seems to me that the big business, as big business, is de facto a manipulator of the public. And that the automobile industry, for example, certainly was trying to set the cultural and ethical standards of the nation in a certain sphere. And they were, you know, telling the public in a sense that there was no alternative, that they were proceeding technologically when in fact they were proceeding, you know, with other kinds of.
Well, I certainly agree that big business helps to set cultural standards. I think it's very easy to exaggerate the extent to which they do it self-consciously. And I want them to do it for one purpose only, to maximize their profits. That's candid and honest, and I can deal with that. But when they start manipulating me to make me a better citizen and all kinds of other, then I don't know what they're doing. I want them to act in accord with their interests, because then I can deal with them.
Then the point is that they should be honest about what they're doing.
Right.
And that certain advertising techniques seem to me to be incompatible with this.
I certainly agree. A lot of this image mongering, big business has talked a lot about social responsibilities. The best, because the worst literature on the subject, I mean, it's the most horrible example, is the McKinsey lectures, which are given annually by the chairman of the board of some large corporation like U.S. Steel and Bell Telephone. And these guys are very interested in asserting that they are socially responsible and that they are indeed trying to create a better society. And I find this manipulative and dishonest. And if these guys are doing this sort of thing, I don't want them to do it. I want them to.
But no matter what they're doing, they're creating a society. And what's wrong with them examining their enterprise to try and create a better society in much the same way that all of us do? Isn't this part of, aren't they part of the democratic fact?
Well, sure.
Then what's wrong with them? Sometimes
what is wrong? Let me put it this way. Let's take a large group. There's nothing wrong with you using your own private resources to contribute to and enrich the public discussion. But there is something wrong with a man who is the president of a corporation, which he does not own, who is the manager of the resources of that corporation. There is something wrong with him using these enormous resources for some purpose ultra vires. He should, I mean, beyond his competence and his charge, he is not to use those resources to remold, because they're not his, to remold society in accord with his heart's desire.
That's
the real danger. I don't think that the problem, this problem is acute for the guy who's in business for himself, because you can't distinguish here between what is his as an individual and what is his as a businessman. It's all mushed together. He can do with his own as he will. Moreover, he typically doesn't have a great deal of economic and social power. It is primarily the large corporation that disturbs me. The large corporation has enormous resources, enormous assets. And I want those assets used in the interest of the stockholders, which requires that they maximize their profits. And if we don't like what results, if we find that the large corporations have too much power to manipulate us in their pursuit of profits, then we, through the political process, should devise new restraints upon this power. But we should not turn to them and say, dear gentlemen, please use your power responsibly.
Well, I mean, in other words, you're against corporate contributions to universities and to operas and to civic arts and...
In principle, yes. Now, fortunately, this is pretty small.
You're against the tax structure that encourages this.
Yes. Oh, yes. Very definitely.
But as an economist, then, don't you think that this tax structure is very important for helping the corporation maximize its profits?
No, the corporation has responded to a tax structure that encourages this kind of thing. We could eliminate a lot of these, I think, undesirable activities by setting up a more sensible tax structure. Essentially, what we've done, you know, in our tax structure, and this just isn't true with the corporate income tax, also with the individual income tax, is we've set the rates higher than most of us really deem tolerable and equitable. There have been surveys find out what percentage do you think of an individual's income should be taxed away if he's in a certain income bracket and so on. And time after time, the results reveal the American public overwhelmingly condemns the present tax rates as too high for all levels of income, especially the upper levels of income. Well, so here we've got this highly progressive tax structure, which people really feel is inequitable. And so we look and we say, well, let's make it more equitable and then we introduce all kinds of loopholes. And then, of course, this leads to you introduce loopholes, people take advantage of loopholes. And an awful lot of things. The double taxation feature is one of the most prominent, where first the income of the corporation is taxed, and then when the corporation pays it out in dividends, it's taxed again. Well, what naturally happens is that the corporation will tend to, for one thing, keep down the volume of dividends that it pays, plow resources back into the corporation, increase the value of the stock, and let the stockholders take their profits in the form of capital gains, which are taxable at a maximum rate of 25%.
But that whole thing is just incredible, you know, along with provisions in the tax structure to encourage capital construction, you know, and investment credit and all this. I mean, it's just to encourage business to grow in construction system. But it seems to me that...
No, it is not. That's not the purpose of it, to encourage business to grow. That's not the original purpose of that tax structure. It wasn't why it was devised that way. Now, the tax credits are a different thing. That did have that purpose.
Well, this part is maybe getting... How about, it seems that if contributions to private colleges, for example, were not tax deductible, and then the corporation would be taxed, you know, on that amount of profit, and then the state would put it into state institutions. Now, I mean, should the state then contribute directly to private institutions?
Well, I think this is getting too far. This is getting too far afield. I mean, I'm afraid
I ask you,
pull back
you
from
that. All the good things that large corporations are currently doing to help the inner city situation at their expense?
Yes. If they're really doing it at their expense, yes. For some very simple reasons. I don't want to rely on this.
It comes into their public relations budget, let's see.
Yeah, sure, that's where they put it. But I like a scheme. I think that the large corporations can make a tremendous contribution to the rehabilitation of our cities, but it should be made profitable for them to do so. For a number of reasons.
Will be.
Because it hasn't been, but we can make it profitable for them.
Who can?
The government. The government.
You want the government to control the business ultimately, but you don't want the business to have to control the responsibility first.
No. I didn't say I want the government to have control of this. Of course I want the government to exercise final control over business.
When they don't build the cars that are safe, then the government should come in and make the regulations.
The government should set standards, yeah.
I don't see why a business couldn't be run for more than just profit. It should be run to build a good car, it should be run to build something they feel is very well needed and not something they advertise and force and make us feel we need.
Now, who forces you to feel you need anything?
If I march in and say I want that car that's safe, and enough people do,
but the point is people don't. Now look, the point is people. The point if you really want, what kind of car do you drive?
That the advertising industry has still made us want product. We all know this car.
You believe you've been?
I won't buy anything named Joy or Thrill because I can't stand them or it's pink full. But we've been.
Have you been brainwashed?
Yeah.
You have. Well, I think there's your problem. You're going to have to recapture your integrity.
Thank you. If I was paying for business, I would have more motive than just profit. You are building a product. You're bringing a product to business. What do you want to do with that product? Don't you want to bring the best product in the best way?
Now look, I'm going to pick on you because you're saying all of these things that you don't mind, do you, Betty? Can I pick on you?
What is so gold about the market?
All right, let me answer your questions one at a time. You want to produce a good, say you're producing a car, you want to produce a good car. How good? Only Cadillacs? Are Chevrolets permissible?
Well, I know, but the thing, the question, see, you're being too abstract. The problem is not should you produce a good car or a bad car. The question is what specific features should be put into the car at what cost? You can make cars that never wear out. You can make Rolls Royces. You can make cars that bump and rattle 3 weeks after you buy them. What kind should?
Obviously, we want to have them wear out. This has become our system.
Yeah, no, wait a minute. Economically, who wants to have them wear out? The fact is that most people, an awful lot of people in this country, get a tremendous amount of, Jerry would say, sexual satisfaction out of changing cars, Andrew. This is, I think, a stupid way to derive satisfaction. But the fact is people want it. Now, if this is bad, who is to say it's bad and who is to change it? The automobile manufacturers couldn't change it if they wanted to. Because they couldn't. Ford tried several years ago to build safety into the cars, to stress safety, and they didn't, people didn't.
They can't combine these qualities.
Look, let me finish the example. Ford tried to stress safety several years ago, and the result was a massive decline in the sale of Ford cars. People didn't want it. You produce a product that's good for people, but which they don't want, and you're not doing anything.
But we also have places in industry that are to sell things, and they're to educate, convince people. And they have to if we're just educating what they want, it's a flashy car instead of making real ideas. This is part of the whole process.
But do you really believe that it is the task of an automobile manufacturer to refine our tastes?
I'm not talking about our tastes, our needs, why you have an automobile, why he is producing an automobile. Why was he doing it in the first place? It's a mode of transportation, and what goes with the mode of transportation.
He's producing it because people want it and he can make a profit in selling it.
He didn't know that in the first place when it was first invented. He had no idea if he could convince these people to give up the hearings or anything.
There's some risk always in business.
Well, sure. And it's a risk to sell a safe car and make them Well, I think that there are more motives than just...
Every man has more motives than just making profits. Every man does. But the corporation, as an entity, the officers of the corporation, when they are acting on behalf of the corporation, ought to make maximum anticipated profit the criterion of their decisions. That's what I'm saying. And you cannot find, I tried to get an awful lot of people who felt that this was inadequate to suggest some alternative criteria or complementary criteria. And the criteria that they come up with turn out to be either meaningless or dangerous.
Paul? Yeah. There's pressures exerted by society, or at least segments of society, particularly in the arts. I noticed in the Seattle area, for instance, quite a bit of pressure exerted upon the Boeing Company, for instance, to make sizable contributions to support sustaining fund for symphony or opera or what have you. And they make comparisons in the newspaper, particularly in the arts review columns, you know, what say the Lilly Company did in Indianapolis or what have you. And the Boeing position, they've always been reluctant since they represent, so to speak, the stockholders, which are all over the country. But yet they get criticism on the local area because they're not assuming a large enough part in sustaining the culture of the community. Mm-hmm. Now you'd stand up and back Boeing 100% in this in their position.
Boeing, of course, has an interest in the Seattle area. They have an interest in making the Seattle area attractive to their personnel so that they can get the kind of people they want at wages that they're willing to pay. So they do have some interest in the community. Whether this
would lead them to make some kind of contribution to the symphony is a matter that, I don't know. But I'm certainly not going to second guess these men. I have no right, certainly, but just because I'm a citizen of Seattle, to say naughty, naughty, irresponsible Boeing. Why should some Boeing stockholder living in Atlanta, Georgia, subsidize the Seattle Symphony Orchestra? I find it unfair, unethical.
Well, isn't
right? Just a second.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Let me say that, as was suggested here, but you said it's getting too far afield, but actually, most of the colleges in the country, aside from the state university and private colleges, about 1,500 of those, I guess, a few of the small ones are supported pretty exclusively by the churches. But all of the large colleges, private colleges, are tied in with the corporations. They have an organization in every state in the union. Well, maybe not every state, but more than 40, 45 states. I was active in one in Minnesota for 10 years, and we went around to the corporations and tried to do our best to convince them of the thing that you say is altogether wrong. And of course, this is done not only in Minnesota, but in all of the states, so that the conclusion of if your line of reasoning is to follow it would be that a major source of income, and perhaps a crucial source of income for every college in the country, would be done away with. And the thing would have to be supported then, it would either have to discontinue as we like it, or it would be supported directly by the state. That would be the
other. Well, since this has now come up twice, let me speak to it. I do believe that, for one thing, I would stress that the amount of support, except in some isolated instances, which colleges do succeed in getting from corporations, is not enough to really, it's not going to be enough to keep them alive.
There's tuition income, so on. It's a very big factor.
It's an important factor. All right, we'll agree, it's an important factor. But remember, who pays the piper calls the tune. And some corporations, since you mentioned Eli Lilly, they are one, they are not willing to give money to a college and let the college make all its own choices. There are certain political principles that some of the men high in Eli Lilly hold to, such as that government should not be contributing to education, to sectarian education. And as a condition, in some cases, of certain grants, they've demanded that the university take a firm stand against government contributions to higher education. This interferes with the university. There are other subtle ways in which there can be interference. I taught in Indiana for a while, and the university which I was teaching was a sizable beneficiary of Eli Lilly grants. And when I discussed problems in the ethical drug industry and what I thought were needed legislative reforms, no one ever put any pressure on me, but at the same time, I felt pressure. Though there were certain things I just shouldn't say. I shouldn't be biting the hand that feeds me. I think this is undesirable. There is an alternative that we have not considered seriously enough, and for saving the private college. I believe firmly in the private college. I think this tendency of the state school to take over all through higher education is a potential disaster. One thing we have not considered is letting the state give tuition vouchers to students who can then spend them where they will. Of course, this has been experimented with New York State. They did it for a long time.
Still do it.
And I think this works well. But there are a lot of people who say, that's irresponsible of New York. They're shifting their responsibilities onto other states. Baloney, they are not. They are simply choosing what I think is ultimately a freer, more democratic, and more efficient way of getting education. I believe in competition in education as well as everywhere else. And the one trouble with trying to educate, give everybody a college education by building enormous state schools is they turn into factories, they become standardized, they do forget about undergraduate education as they become factories for graduate students, with all the faculty interested in the graduate students and their research and publications. So there is another way out. I sort of think, at the present time, unless we're willing to re-examine this whole question of higher education, how we intend to support it, and whether we want to keep the private college alive, and if so, how we can do it, I think that until we
get into the whole question, well, at least I'm not going to go around screaming too loudly that corporations should stop making contributions to college. And you see, here once again, maybe my private interest, I'm still teaching in a private school, is warping my judgment. And that's basically the problem. Private individual interest always warps judgment. And that's why I don't like private individual interests to have too much control in society. And that's why I'm very unhappy when I hear about corporations out of their magnanimous hearts giving so much money to public causes. I suspect it really isn't a magnanimous heart. What is the president of a large corporation really doing when he contributes to the cultural causes in his city and makes a huge contribution to the Heart Fund and so on? The basic thing he's doing is buying for himself out of his stockholders' pockets a feeling of being a big wheel and a generous man. I think if he wants to be generous, he should be generous out of his own income.
Paul?
Yes.
Well, you were using the term magnanimous, which I think probably tips it off. I was born in Pennsylvania, which of course is a great mining state, and near where I live were a lot of mining towns, not unlike in any respect to the piece of ground that we're sitting on. Most of these mining towns, the people who lived in them were captive in a certain way as much as the people who lived up here. That is to say, they couldn't get in their car and drive away because usually they didn't have a car anyway, especially back in the early 1900s. And later, I mean, in other words, the early stages of these mining towns, where people were, as Tennessee Ernie Ford let us know in the song, 16 tons and whether you get another day older and deeper in debt, and the I owe my soul to the company store. Well now, that was the typical mining town of Pennsylvania. Now you're sitting on a piece of property that was developed by Howe Sound, now called HowNet, which is large enough corporation that the day before the 4th of July, it was the fourth largest trading stock in the New York Stock Exchange. They built this mining town here, and according to Carl Linderly, the publicity that I read, was the finest mining town in the world. Now the word finest doesn't mean that they crushed the copper ore any better than anybody else, or that they drilled holes in better directions and with more engineering skill. I'm sure it referred to the plant that you're sitting in right now. It had a hospital, unlike most mining towns. It had a bowling alley and a various things that Howe Sound didn't have to build in 1937 during the Depression. People would have come up here and worked in tents if they had to. So apparently Howe Sound, through their magnanimous heart, felt that maybe this was the way to build a mining town. That maybe when people came up here and they found out that the miners didn't like to work with their families away, they built a place where the families could live. And when the children grew up, why, they built Honeymoon Hill, where they could live by themselves. So I think this is what most people are referring to when they talk about social responsibility of a large corporation. Howe Sound, in building this plant right here, obviously had more social responsibility than Frick Coal Company did in 1901 when they built their various coal.
Well, maybe they did, maybe they didn't.
They also knew what they had to do to compete in the labor market.
Right. Even in 1937, sure, you could get people to come up here, but could you get them to stay?
Right.
How about your turnover problem? Serious problem. I think if I were trying to create a mining village up here, I'd build something about like this, because it would be vitally important in this isolated area that you have a sense of community, that you provide recreational activities so the people don't start boozing it up at night, getting into fights. And I suspect that an awful lot of these things that Howe Sound did up here were just sensible from a business point of view. I think you could justify every one of them. Little thing like Honeymoon Heights up there, minimal expense to the company with tremendous community results. And when you can spend a couple of nickels
and get real satisfaction and even love for the company out of it, that's a wise way to spend your nickels.
Why didn't more other companies do it that way then? Look at the logging industry. They built all kinds of terrible logging camps in the same country.
Maybe they were stupid.
They weren't equally.
Well, they made plenty of money doing it the way they were. Why should they do any better? If you can make a big profit that way, why should you feel them any better? I'm just saying there must be another motive. Plenty of people did this without going that further step.
Well,
you think it really was because it was so sensible and how Tom did it? I mean, how can we say it?
Well, let me just say, if it isn't sensible business practice, can you count on the businessman to do it? And the answer, obviously, is no, because we, right, and yet we are willing to depend, we're willing to depend upon something which we can see historically has been a shaky reed indeed. If what companies are led to do in the pursuit of private interest is not socially satisfactory, it is the task of society, through the political process, to intervene and control the situation. And appealing to these businessmen to be good fellas hasn't worked in the past and won't work now. It ain't gonna work. Through the political process. We are so far behind in pollution because we haven't made laws. And one reason we haven't made laws is because we've been telling businessmen, come on, fellas, be responsible.
No. So you don't have to be responsible, you can do it any way you want.
Well, we've been preaching conservation for years, and our atmosphere is getting polluted. I think it's time that we intervene, and that we, if a businessman puts smoke in the air, he pays. And we make him pay so much that it becomes profitable for him to stop putting smoke in the air.
But it's too late then. If he had started in the beginning to realize it was profitable to run his business in a way that it didn't.
And if Adam hadn't eaten the apple, but...
but he got started.
Harold and Paul, you want to make... Paul would say something.
The best way to regulate corporations and things like pollution and stuff is with, you know, financial incentives. But why do we have to restrict ourselves to negative financial incentives? I mean, we're in favor of a democratic pluralism. It seems that positive financial incentives, giving corporations an outlet to express their private interests, is really going to strengthen the democracy in terms of this is another way to compete and another way to really help your corporation gain a better financial strength.
I'm not against positive incentives. In fact,
incentives are tax things to allow corporations to contribute to private colleges or to other, things.
Well, this is a desirable kind of way of getting support for private colleges. I just don't happen to believe that that's a desirable technique. But going back to what Betty was talking about, the rejuvenation of the inner city, I think that we can provide not just tax incentives, but schemes whereby the government is a purchaser of certain kinds of facilities, which then private corporations erect. And here it becomes in their interest then to do all sorts of things that they are marvelously well equipped and organized to do. And this is providing positive incentive. No, I'm not against positive incentive at all.
Specifically, what you're against then is a few certain corporate leaders investing money to glorify their own particular ends on behalf of the stockholders.
No, they're not doing it on behalf of the stockholders.
No, but I mean supposedly with the stockholders' money.
Yeah.
In other words, what you're against is mismanagement of corporate funds.
I am against surrendering the public interest to private individuals. That's one thing I'm against. I'm against supposing that the public interest can be adequately cared for by private whim and caprice, and of course in calling it whim and caprice I'm kind of prejudicing the issue, but I'm also opposed to any use of resources which don't belong to you, especially when they're enormous resources that have been entrusted to you for a different purpose, the use of these to gratify your own personal ideas of what would be a good society or good television fare or a nice community or better culture.
You're not not really, which I guess is a sort of extreme application of what you may consider to be a good practice.
Well, I think I'm against the practice.
But you said that it would be for tax incentives for the corporation to contribute to public things.
No. I didn't say anything about contributing. I'm against tax incentives for corporations to contribute to anything. Because you give them the incentives and there's no guarantee that they will contribute to any particular cause. I don't think that the government...
That's what we want. I mean, you want the government to... Okay.
I didn't hear that. What?
I mean, as long as the incentives don't have any strings on it, we'll say that you want the corporations to invest in many different areas and actually...
Invest and contribute are two different things.
Well, contribute because it strengthens the financial position of the company.
Well, a contribution that strengthens the financial
because
position of the company is a strange... There's confusion there.
Well, why does companies contribute? I mean, obviously it turns out to help their balance sheet better.
No. No, it simply makes it, it's not true. It simply makes it less costly for them to do so. But a corporation does not, except in very, very rare cases where there's certain, very, very complicated cases where you get a wishy-bang accountant tax lawyer in there to show you how you can actually make a profit by giving something away.
But
these cases are rare.
Not that kind of thing.
Yeah, but most of their contributions do not make money for them. Most of their contributions simply are partially subsidized by the government.
They save a lot of money.
No, look, when you make a charitable, it's essentially like when you make a charitable contribution, you don't save money. It's just that the government is saying, I'll pay 25% of whatever you choose to contribute. So you don't make more money by giving money away. You cut your tax bill, but you increase your charitable contributions by more than you cut your tax bill, and that's the typical case with the corporation.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, when I was a tax accountant,
well, you were dealing with a peculiar case then.
I was just going to ask you, though, the stockholders of a large corporation don't agree with the judgment the president used in the board of directors. Can't they, by their own democratic process, re-elect a new board, a new president, and exercise it well like the stockholder in Atlanta who doesn't like what Boeing did?
Yeah, that's assuming that stockholders actually have control over corporation officers. In fact, they don't. They can't.
Who has control of corporations?
Well, management today in most large publicly held corporations is an automatic self-perpetuating oligarchy. Management chooses its own successors, and as you know, it's almost impossible to unseat the existing management.
The problem is, you're talking about General Motors and all the huge corporations. Look at all the inner group of moderately small to large corporations where the stockholders really do run the corporation, so to speak. They don't like the president or the management and the type of judgment they use in giving away the corporate funds for inner city or cultural aspects. They can change a management and say, declare a dividend. We want to decide this ourselves, and we'll get our own money when it comes back to it. Isn't that true? Rather than go the government process, which I don't like, I'd rather see the corporations and stockholders run their own company.
Yeah, you know, this 9:15. We gotta quit. I shouldn't quit with a nasty remark, but I get the. It's often talking to businessmen. They come back to this. They say, "But we don't want the government doing it. We want to do it ourselves." And this isn't true in your case, I know, because you're a fine man. But I'm afraid what many businessmen are saying is that we kind of like this world in which we are the cultural and social czars, and we don't want the federal government intervening because that might diminish our freedom and power.
That's true, but if his stockholders don't question his decision, then he can assume that all his stockholders feel as he does and agree with what he's doing. Not him personally, but the old people that own that particular enterprise.
Maybe.
But why should you be dictated by someone bigger than you? The biggest company in the family.